30s. Right now it's 52 in Boston.
Early this morning of April 19th, 1775, CBS learned that General Thomas Gage, Commander-in-Chief of the British Army here in the American colonies, has dispatched at least 800 of His Majesty's regular troops from Boston to Concord. The Redcoats have been ordered to do two things. To seize the military supplies which the colonists have recently been storing in Concord, and to arrest Samuel Adams and John Hancock, the top leaders of the Sons of Liberty, the organization which is the spearhead of the colonial resistance movement. At this moment, the Redcoats are somewhere on the road to Concord. They left Boston by the Charles River crossing early last evening, and though General Gage made a serious effort to keep the expedition a secret, news of it...
April 19th, 1775, His Majesty's regulars march on Concord. You are there.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. What you've just heard is the transcribed opening of a radio program presented 54 years ago on the CBS radio network called You Are There. The program used the broadcast techniques of that day to recreate the seminal events marked by Patriots Day, April 18, 1775, specifically the battles of Lexington, Concord, and the running fight that lasted all the way back to Boston. Tonight, as we hear excerpts from that program, we'll get comments from a historian and a broadcaster as to how such events affect our images of ourselves as Americans 227 years later. Now to the reporters from You Are There as they set the stage.
Don Hollenbeck is ready to report from Concord, so over to Don Hollenbeck.
I'm in Concord's town square in front of Wright's Tavern. It's still dark, but there's a bright moon. There are candles in the windows, torches on the square. The citizens have been awakened. The belfry bell has roused them from their beds. They're gathering here in the square, falling in under command of Colonel James Barrett and hiding supplies. They've been hiding them for 3 days. Apparently, their underground has warned them that General Gage would march. Here with me at our microphone is the man who brought the news of General Gage's march to Concord. He's Dr. Samuel Prescott, a town resident, rather young for a doctor, only 20 years old. Dr. Prescott, what's your opinion? Will peace survive General Gage's expedition?
No, it can't, sir. We'll be in open rebellion before morning.
Why do you say that, Doctor? Do you think there'll be trouble here in Concord?
Well, maybe yes, maybe no, but there's 21 miles between Boston and Concord. There's Roxbury Town, Bedford, Lexington, Mystic, and dozens of others. In every one of those towns, the Minutemen have been pulled out of bed, and they're itching for a fight. They don't like the Lobsterbacks, and the Lobsterbacks don't like them. Does that look like trouble, or doesn't it?
But, Dr. Prescott, there's been violence before, but no open rebellion.
Well, this time it's different. You don't send 800 regulars to a tea party. If Gage means fight, he'll find us ready.
You mean you'll fire on the Redcoats when they appear?
We'll fire on no one unless they give us cause to fire on them. We've never fired first. They've always provoked us. We mean not to attack, but always to defend our rights as Englishmen.
Dr. Prescott, would you mind telling us just how you came by the information that Gage's troops are on the march?
Not at all. I was in Lexington last night. I went to see a young lady. As I was riding home, I met Billy Dawes and Paul Revere.
Paul Revere, that's the Boston silversmith?
That's right.
Yes, and isn't Revere also the messenger for the provincial Congress?
Well, I wouldn't know about that.
Who sent him out?
I haven't the faintest.
I don't suppose you know where Sam Adams and Hancock are either.
No, I wouldn't, sir.
Well, go on with your story. What did Paul Revere and Dawes tell you when they met you in Lexington?
It was outside of Lexington on the road to Concord. I was going to ride in with them to Concord when we met four Lobsterbacks. Cursed rebels, they called us. They said they knew we'd been rousing the militia, threatened to blow out our brains. They ordered us into a pasture. I took my chances, though. I spurred my horse over a stone wall by Folly Pond and shook them off. So did Billy. But they caught Revere, Lord help him.
Where's Dawes now?
I don't know. I can't answer any more questions. I've got to fall in with the Minutemen.
Thank you very much. That was Dr. Samuel Prescott, who brought the report that General Gage's troops are on their way here to Concord. You heard him say that, in his opinion, the colonies will be in open rebellion before morning. If he's correct, if rebellion does come, it's a question if these local Minutemen can carry through successfully against the highly trained and well-supplied redcoats of His Majesty's forces. This Concord militia is a strange mixture of farmers, young boys, old men, seasoned Indian fighters. None of them has a uniform. They're dressed in crude homespun pants and cotton shirts. A few wear the familiar three-cornered hat worn in this section of the colonies. But their battle gear is pathetically inadequate. Some have a powder horn slung over their shoulders and firelock muskets, but a few have no weapons at all. Occasionally, some of them wander in and out of Wright's Tavern and partake generously of mugs of hot rum flip. Their womenfolk are helping with the stores. They're priming muskets, giving their husbands loaves of bread and salt pork, extra pairs of warm stockings. John Daly in Lexington, 6 miles from here, has just reported that the regulars have been sighted, so over to John Daly in Lexington.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien, and before we go to Lexington, we're joined by College of Arts and Sciences history professor Jill Lepore and former ABC newsman and current chairman of the Department of Journalism at the College of Communication, Professor Robert Zelnick. Professor Zelnick is also a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Welcome to both of you, and thanks for joining me on tonight's Boston University World of Ideas. Now, as we listen to this 50-plus-year-old program, I want to keep several things in mind. Number one is that this is about an historical event. What do we know about historical events? What do we know in terms of reporting of those events? Is it history? Is it journalism? What's going on?
Well, what we know about this event really comes down to us from the few accounts kept by people who took part in those events. And there are not a whole lot of those. There are some official accounts on the part of the British Army. What there also are recollections from many years later, and those are some of the most dubious sources that historians have, although they're often the richest. As you can imagine, people like Samuel Prescott later in life would look back on this event and elaborate to some considerable degree, so that a lot of what historians would say is inadmissible as evidence in this event are those very rich stories that come down to us in the form of memoirs, for instance, and recollections. But there are a fair number of firsthand accounts of Revolutionary War events, and those have a great deal to offer us in terms of getting a sense of what actually happened on that day. The way that we look at them as historians is really masked by the great amount of myth that came out of this event that's really richly evoked in that great clip we just listened to. And I guess I would point most of all to the myth of the casual farmer in his crude homespun pants, pathetically inadequately armed, you know, going in and out of Wright's Tavern, getting a drink, and this unprofessional military man whom Americans think fought and won the revolution against the well-organized regimental British Army.
We're going to go into that in a little bit later after we listen to some more excerpts. But Professor Zelnick, obviously these are applying the techniques of 50 years ago in terms of reporting to an event that occurred, a long time previously, 173 years from that point. What familiarity do you feel when you listen to this?
Well, I feel great familiarity because as inadequate as memoirs and historical recollections may be, they tend to be a lot more accurate when put together and filtered through the wisdom of a historian than is possible for a journalist to report in the fog of war based on what he's seeing with his eyes and hearing with his ears, which is usually a very, very small, minute part of what's going on. And every time that I've been in such a situation, I have recognized the inadequacy.
That it's a narrow kind of snapshot in time that somebody like you, Professor Lepore, has to put together with other snapshots.
Well, it's a snapshot in time with three-quarters of the lens hidden.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think there is a great advantage that historians have, that there's this whole wealth and diversity of sources that we can employ standards of evidence to think about which ones are more likely to give us a better sense of it. But I think one of the real analogs between this radio broadcast and what historians do is that there are no pictures. And most of what you want today, and what Americans want when they, you know, are thinking about, you know, as we talked about what's going on in Afghanistan or what's going on in Israel and Palestine today, people have visual images that serve as really a kind of shorthand for the whole of that story. And that doesn't exist with how we understand the American Revolution.
Okay, well, let's move on. Let's find out what's happening in Lexington. And we'll pick up the CBS program You Are There with the latest from the Lexington Green.
Here on Lexington Green in front of the Buckman Tavern, we can see His Majesty's regulars approaching on the Boston Road about 150 yards off. The sun is coming up and we can see them clearly, a mass of red-coated men, their officers, marching on either side of the column and in front of it, too. I can't tell you yet who their commanding officer is. It's probably Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith. He's led these sorties of General Gage before. The fife and drum unit is playing Yankee Doodle, and as you can hear, playing it very badly, playing it very sourly. That, no doubt, as a deliberate insult to the colonists. It's an old trick of the English regulars. They've done it before in Boston, marching past the meetings of the Sons of Liberty. Captain Parker's militia is almost completely assembled here on the green. Over 60 of his complement of 75 men are already here, and latecomers are quickly filling in the ranks. The Minutemen are drawn up in double line with their muskets at their side. If the decision is up to Captain Parker, there'll be no open rebellion here at Lexington. If Captain Parker had meant to challenge His Majesty's regulars, why, he would have blocked the road to Concord. But instead, he's assembled his men here on the green, and he's given them very explicit orders not to fire unless fired upon. About 40 of the villagers, spectators, are standing about, leaning out of windows, lolling in doorways, or swinging their legs on a stone wall, and it certainly hardly seems as if any of them expect any trouble here. The big question now is, what will the regulars do when they march to the fork in the road that leads on to Concord? If they keep right on marching to Concord, well, then there'll be no trouble here this morning. Oh, there's Paul Revere coming out of the tavern. The British captured him, but released him, and he returned to Lexington just a short while ago.
Mr. Revere! Mr. Revere, this is CBS.
Sorry, no time.
Mr. Revere has gone by. He and another man are carrying a chest, and it doesn't look as if Paul Revere thinks there's going to be any trouble here. He certainly wouldn't be so calmly carrying that chest across Lexington Green if he did. The redcoats are almost at the fork in the road now, a mixture of grenadiers in their high, pointed caps and light infantry. There are no field pieces, no artillery, since there was no prospect of a formal engagement when the redcoats left their barracks. They had hoped, as a matter of fact, to catch Concord completely by surprise, as you've probably been told. The redcoats' ranks are orderly, bayonets gleaming in the rising sun. The officers, handsome as usual, with their beautifully powdered wigs and their lace cuffs. Many of the regulars, we can see now, they're close enough, are covered with mud from the waist down. They've evidently waded through some kind of marsh country. And the commanding officer is not Colonel Smith. I can tell you that much. He's a younger man, a major, in fact, by his uniform, an officer not of the Army, but of the Royal Marines. And I don't recognize him. The fifes have stopped playing. The commanding officer has given the order to halt. The order is repeated down the line, and the major has ordered his men to prime and glow. 800 redcoats are loading their muskets. We can't tell yet if the major seriously means to fire or if this is just a maneuver to intimidate Parker and the militia. Captain Parker hasn't moved, but some of his men are calling out. Some seem to think it's folly to stand, since they're hopelessly outnumbered, but others are against breaking ranks. That's Captain
quiet,
Parker talking.
Listen to me! The first man who offers to run shall be shot down. Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien, and tonight we're reliving the events of Patriots Day with the help of the CBS program You Are There, which originally aired in 1948, and with the help of historian Jill Lepore and journalism professor Bob Zelnick. Before we start talking about the specific event and how a quotation like that, for example, could come down to us these many years later and be accurate, when do we start thinking about good guys and bad guys? Is it a question of the winners writing the history?
Well, I think in this instance, we certainly have been thinking about good guys and bad guys for a long time before April 19th, 1775. I mean, the whole resistance movement is designed in part to politicize the colonial population in opposition to the king and parliament. Since the end of the French and Indian War in 1763, American colonists have become increasingly suspicious of the British army. They become increasingly suspicious that England represents arbitrary authority over a free people seeking merely to protect their own political liberty. And so the events of Lexington and Concord, when they happen, are really pre-scripted in a sense. And what's made of them is really very, again, well illustrated in these clips, because you can see why Lexington and Concord is a useful story for Americans to tell themselves, and to tell themselves in this very specific way, because it's all about these freedom-loving farmers merely going about their own business. They're invaded. They're invaded by people who march in regiments and wear big powdered wigs. All these tiny little details, which are really meant to evoke the kind of humble, hardworking yeoman that the American colonist is versus the kind of insanely tyrannical British army.
Well, wasn't there some accuracy to that caricature, at least in the early stages? These were militiamen. They were many of them farmers. It wasn't really until maybe Valley Forge when they had a chance to train and discipline the troops and try to convert them into an army of a disciplined, effective army the following spring.
Well, it's certainly true that there are a number, there are provincial militias, and then there are individual militiamen. But the war is won by the Continental Army, and the Continental Army has a lot of problems raising troops, and it fights against the prevailing notion. I mean, American colonists didn't believe that there should be a professional army. So they have this myth of what, you know, what they called the citizen soldier, the idea that you would one day be out hoeing your field and the next day you'd take your gun and you'd go fight. You cannot win a war that way. You certainly can't win a war against the British Army. And so Americans always struggled with the contradiction between the war they had to fight and the way they had to fight to win it, and how they wanted to think of themselves as a people. And so Lexington and Concord is a much more important battle for us in our remembrance than many other Revolutionary War battles, because it fits the myth that even Americans at the time really wanted to embrace.
And what about the reportage that's going on here, too? Is the same sense of confusion, waiting for somebody to come by so you can grab him? They wanted to talk to Paul Revere. He didn't have any time. They talked.
Well, he treated the press the same way that some of the modern soldiers treat the press. Maybe there's more precedent in this than we think. But I could imagine in the pace of the war that was carried on in those days, a reporter in the battlefield going back and forth. Of course, it didn't happen. And indeed, right through the Civil War, very often the papers back home relied not on correspondence in the field, although by the time of the Civil War there were several, but relied on the letters written by soldiers from the battlefield to their families that were then shared with the newspapers and presented an incomplete but very real picture of a little portion of combat.
What about the broadsheets of that time? Were they political and of all stripes, or was it organized and some attempt made at being, objective?
There's no attempt at being made at objective. That's a development in the history of journalism that comes quite a bit later. The resistance movements have this great precedence of the Committees of Correspondence, which are the Sons of Liberty's attempts to formalize and institutionalize a way to use the post and messaging services to get news throughout the colonies, really to try to nationalize the 13 colonies and make sure everyone knows what's going on. So a lot of the reporting that's done is through that. But newspapers are in retreat at this point. Isaiah Thomas, who's the publisher of the Massachusetts Spy, moves his offices from Boston to Worcester because he can't publish during the British occupation of Boston.
Okay. Right now, let's go back to the Lexington Green and reporter John Daly.
You heard Captain Parker. He's told his minutemen to... The red-coated major has ordered his men up on the green, and they're advancing on the double, bayonets at charge, two platoons of three ranks each. Some of Captain Parker's militia have broken ranks, are running away, but most of them are still there, standing at attention, muskets at their sides. His Majesty's regulars have halted, guns leveled at the double line of minutemen. The two opposing forces are face-to-face, rigid and resolved. That's the major. He's galloped up on the green with two officers.
Disperse,
ye rebels, he cries out. Gee, villains, disperse. Captain Parker's face is drawn, his lips are tight. He hasn't answered. His men haven't moved.
Break ranks, minutemen, break ranks!
And that was Captain Parker. He called out, break ranks, break ranks. He's ordered the minutemen to break their ranks.
Bless you! Why don't you lay down your arms?
The major has ordered the dispersing militia to lay down its arms. He's not satisfied with their dispersal alone. He's shouting at the minutemen. He's waving his sword angrily. Someone has fired a shot. I couldn't see where it came from. It seemed to come from my left. It may have been... The red
Marshal took fire point blank at the militiamen. Some of Captain Carter's men have fallen, three of them. Five now. The major is pointing his sword downward, trying to prevent another volley. He did not order the firing of that first volley. The militiamen are firing back without a command, without any order of any kind, spontaneously, in anger. The major's horse has been hit. It's rearing up. The spectators are running for cover, the women screaming. Everything is confusion, and the green is choked with musket smoke. A redcoat has been hit, but the militia have broken completely. They're fleeing in all directions. Both sides are firing freely, but most of the firing is coming from the redcoats. The redcoats are running after the minutemen, firing as fast as they can prime and reload. The major is still trying to stop his men from firing to get some semblance of order, but his men are out of hand. A minuteman has been bayoneted on the spot because he refused to move. Some of the redcoats are trying to break into the meeting house, and they're breaking down the door. There must be at least six minutemen lying dead here, and more have been wounded. I don't see any of Captain Parker's militiamen now. They've all disappeared. The redcoats are quieting down. Their officers are getting them back into line on the road. Some of them are still firing when they think they see a colonial. The major is swearing at his men. The situation exploded in his hands.
Who gave you command to fire? Why didn't you obey the order? I'll have every man deck of you hanged to the nearest tree. You confounded Jervis, come! Attention!
The major is very angry and dressing down his troops. The smoke is clearing. The regulars are flushed, wild-eyed, panting. Some of the wives of the minutemen who were hit are running out on the green to help their husband. I can count eight fallen men. Eight altogether. I can't tell you whether they're dead or wounded. On the other side, except for a slight injury to the major's horse and that one wounded redcoat who seems to have been just grazed, the redcoats have suffered no casualties. The redcoat, in spite of the major, has cried out hotly, three cheers for victory. But the major has given the command to march, and the long red column is stepping off down the road to Concord to the fife music and the drums. Evidently, the major isn't allowing this awful clash that has just taken place on Lexington Green to divert him from his main objective, the military stores in Concord, and the arrest of Sam Adams and John Hancock. The wife of one of the militiamen is running after the redcoats, screaming at them.
Well, that's a very breathtaking description of the Lexington engagement. How do we know what actually happened there? Is it the letters again and the source documents that tell us that, the recollections of the soldiers years later, as you indicated earlier, Professor Lepore?
Yeah, well, we don't really rely on those recollections. They have a lot of problems with them, but they're fun to read. We really know from what people wrote at the time, diary entries and letters and accounts that people left behind them. But I think that one of the things that gets lost in this on-the-scene reporting, which is a great metaphor for how historians do their work in some ways, is how much we don't know and how much is confusing. So, for instance, if you compare this with the Boston Massacre in 1770, and you imagine Paul Revere's engraving, which most people kind of have a visual image of the redcoats lined up with their bayonets and they're shooting at these kind of very innocent-looking victims. Here we have an instance of Revere really trying to shape how people understood the events that had just happened by so clearly politicizing them. But if you contrast, say, Revere's engraving with the sources that survive from that event, which is the legal trial of the British soldiers for murder, at which John Adams served as the lawyer for the defense.
This was a massacre.
The Boston Massacre, which is kind of similar to this scene. I mean, just in terms of what goes on.
And a little bit later, this could have been treated as a Boston Massacre type situation,
right.
And no war need have started.
Right. It could have been taken to court in that same way. But when you look at the trial testimony from the Boston Massacre, all sorts of witnesses are trotted in, and they come up with all sorts of stories about where they were standing and what they saw, and then the smoke did this, and they heard someone say fire, but did they mean fire because there was a fire coming, you know, but there was a fire brigade coming, or fire shoot? Was it a command to fire on the masses? You get a sense from reading those trial transcripts of just how difficult it is, even at the time, for a court to come to any conclusion about who fired first, whether they were provoked, who fell first, what was said. You can get a very great sense from the transcripts from the 1770 hearings of just how much, if this interviewer had been actually really interviewing everyone,
yes,
we'd be getting conflicting reports.
Well, we still don't know who fired the first shot. I mean, that's historically
accurate. We know it was heard around the world, though.
Yes. Well, the Redcoats killed and wounded several people and just left them there. Was that common at that time on battlefields? If you went down, you stayed there?
No, it was for your own side to try to retrieve the dead and wounded and take appropriate care of them. The Redcoats, as we heard in this report, were on their way to fulfill another mission, which was to confiscate weapons and to make an arrest.
Okay, the program was first broadcast, Bob, in 1948, as we've mentioned at the beginning of the segment of the news program. One of these segments, they have difficulty locating John Daly. They can't find him. He's in a mobile unit. They were reporting live. It was just beginning to come in post-World War II, and it was used in Korea and in Vietnam. How does the practice compare to what we're seeing today? In the recent fighting in Afghanistan, did we get a live report of any?
Well, first of all, you had very, very few, if any, live reports from Korea or Vietnam. In fact, having started my career as a freelancer in Vietnam, I knew that the television people used to shoot the film. They didn't have tape that they used then, and send it out for development. And it was sometimes a day, 2 or 3 days later before it aired on Walter Cronkite or Huntley and Brinkley. The notion of live battlefield reporting, particularly involving visual equipment, really didn't start until the tail end of the Persian Gulf War, when you had Forrest Sawyer from ABC accompanying an Egyptian group that was advancing, and you had McEwen, a CBS reporter, going up the road into Kuwait City. And this has added many, many complications to war reporting, maybe a little bit off subject. But
well, no, I asked the question because it appeared that the Dan Rathers and the Ron Nessens, Morley Safer, there was an immediacy to the reporting because they were right with the troops, even if the film or tape ran some days later. And that we didn't see that so much in the Persian Gulf War or Afghanistan.
You saw some of it in Afghanistan, but not too much involving American forces. The reporters were able to accompany the Northern Alliance, for example, and broadcast there, or the effort to dislodge the Al-Qaeda from the Tora Bora area.
Right.
But this is quite a complicating feature of war reporting, because a live reporter on the scene can very easily compromise the security of the operation and put soldiers' lives in jeopardy. So on the other hand, many would say the military has overreacted. Instead of proposing common sense rules to govern this kind of thing, they've kept the reporters at arm's length altogether, which is a disservice to our contemporaries and a disservice to historians like Jill.
All right. Are we going back to a pre-electronic mode of historical record-keeping because of the difficulties you point out, whether one would say it was censorship, somebody else would say it was necessary for the security of the operation? Well, that's a question we'll leave. And now we'll go to New York for more of the developing situation with Don Hollenbeck.
This is Don Hollenbeck in New York. Come in, Doug Edwards in Concord. Go ahead, Doug Edwards. We don't know why Doug Edwards isn't answering our signal to Concord. We're trying to check. There's been an exchange of shots, as you've heard, between the Colonial Minutemen and His Majesty's regulars who are marching on Concord. CBS headquarters in Boston has been trying to get a statement from General Gage, but the general is not available for comment. However, our Boston headquarters has been able definitely to identify the major of the Royal Marines who is leading this expedition to Concord. He's Major John Pitcairn, 35. He lives in Boston, close by the house of Paul Revere. The entire contingent is under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith. Reports continue to come in claiming that the colonial militia in at least a dozen villages in the Boston area have been aroused and are marching toward the road between Concord and Boston. There's been no further information concerning the whereabouts of Samuel Adams and John Hancock. Both men are known, however, to be in the Boston area. We're still trying to reach Doug Edwards in Concord. And now, here is Major Elliott.
The meaning of the tragedy that has happened on Lexington Green is still pretty obscure here in New York. Does this occurrence mean that there is no hope for peace? It's still much too early to decide that. The colonies are, of course, painfully familiar with other such bloody clashes. Clashes that have happened in the past. And still, there's been no open, organized rebellion as a result. Unless further investigation reveals that it was a militiaman who fired that mysterious first shot, John Daly's eyewitness account would certainly seem to indicate that Captain Parker's men obeyed his order not to fire unless fired upon. The militiamen seemed to have fired their muskets only in response to the concentrated volley of the regulars. However, when word of what has happened in Lexington spread through the New England countryside and the rest of the colonies, this word will certainly pour no water on the rising flames of resistance. And now, here again is Don Hollenbeck.
Thank you, Major Elliott. Ken Roberts in Concord is calling in from a mobile transmitter. Go ahead, Ken Roberts.
Well, we're not going to go to Ken Roberts right now. We're going instead to Professor Joe Lepore of the Department of History and historian, and Professor Bob Zelnick from the College of Communication. I'm Ted O'Brien, and you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Already now, in the program, we have a Major Elliott, obviously British, who is beginning to try to spin the event or damp it down a little bit. Were attempts made at that time by some people in Britain or in charge to write this off as an aberration or a problem or to avoid an open break?
Certainly there were. What's great about this program is you see how in the radio broadcast, all that period of doubt and uncertainty where the spin isn't clear is compressed into a matter of minutes, even maybe over the course of the day we might expect that these statements would emerge and in a way that if there was a breaking news story today, we would expect there to be a press conference by the end of the day. That took weeks and months in the
yes.
case of Lexington and Concord. And to the extent that war was ever declared, war couldn't really be declared until the colonies declared themselves an independent nation. That doesn't happen until July of 1776, well over a year later. So slow everything down when you expect when things are going to happen, when news is even going to really travel outside of New England, that shots have even been fired. While this is going on, members of the Second Continental Congress are trying to make their way for the Congress, and they kind of hear rumors and some of them turn back, and there's a lot of confusion for an awfully long while.
So what was the Continental Congress? Paul Revere was the messenger for the Continental Congress. When did that get set up, and what did the British have to say about that?
The Continental Congress was set up to form an oppositional body to the provincial legislatures to say that there ought to be an intercolonial cooperative body that had no warrant in law, was an extra legal authority where delegates from each of the colonies could get together to debate what to do and how to proceed with the resistance movement. And so it was delegates from that Congress.
But it was still short of open rebellion. It was still an attempt to call the attention of the king to problems here.
Absolutely. There's no open rebellion at this point. Remember, in the spring of 1776, the Continental Congress, mainly what it does is send the king the olive branch petition, mm-hmm. which is exactly what you think it means. They're still asking the king to kind of forgive them and patch everything up.
So what was the argument about? I mean, it was freeborn Englishmen against freeborn Englishmen, and they didn't apparently hate each other. I know that some of the troops that the British were British regulars were actually Germans.
Well, I'm not having been a reporter at the time. I will go on what I've read, and that is that there were elements of opposition that were opposed to specific British policies which they regarded as unjust, taxation without representation, etc. They were essentially your reformers of the period. They wanted to keep the relationship pretty much intact, but they wanted reform. There were others that wanted separation from the colonies, from the British. They didn't have any particular political objectives or particular political vision. But they felt they would prosper and thrive better if they were independent. The third group were the Jeffersonian type, the ones that had a real vision of changing the political order and providing an entirely new type of system.
All right. So now the fat begins to go into the fire, and let's find out what Ken Roberts is up to in Concord.
Are you getting me okay, Don?
Yes, Ken. Yes, go ahead. Where are you?
I'm on a hill outside of Concord.
Where's Doug Edwards?
He's inside the town. His Majesty's regulars have arrived. They've occupied Concord. We had transmission trouble before. That's why Edwards didn't get through. And when we were ready to report again, the regulars had moved in, taken over the town, and Lieutenant Colonel Smith had clamped down a tight censorship. I managed to get away from town in our mobile unit. I'm wearing a PAC transmitter, and I'm here now with the Concord Militia, overlooking the North Bridge.
What are the militia doing on the hill, Ken?
Major Buttrick of Concord is conferring with his men. There are about 400 of them now. The men of Concord have been joined by others from Chemford, Carlisle, Littleton, and Bedford. They're trying to decide what to do about some smoke that's curling up from the center of Concord. The men don't know what's burning, but some of them are afraid the Redcoats have set their homes on fire and are trying to burn down the whole town. The only thing that's stopping them from going in immediately and finding out is the detail of Redcoats down there at the North Bridge. There are three companies down there, all about 100 men, commanded by Captain Laurie of the 43rd Foot. That North Bridge is the only direct way back into Concord, and Captain Laurie's Redcoats are blocking the way.
We're going in! Fall in column of two!
Oh, that was Major Buttrick. He's given the command for the militia to fall in. And I think the Minutemen are going to try to cross the bridge. I don't know what Captain Laurie's orders are. I don't know whether he's been given any orders, but the big question is whether he'll let the Minutemen cross that bridge. We'll know any moment now. The Minutemen have struck up a march. I think it's the White Cockade. Two by two, they're approaching the bridge. I'm following the column. Major Buttrick is leading. Captain Davis, commanding the contingent from Acton, is walking at his side. All the men are walking steadily with great resolution. They're not speaking now. They're not looking to right or left. Their eyes are fastened on the regulars on the other side of the Concord River, watching the imposing mass of scarlet uniforms that sort of funnels into the entrance of the North Bridge. The regulars know the Minutemen are coming. Well, Captain Laurie has shouted a command to his men. I couldn't hear it. He's still too far away. But the Redcoats have taken up the traditional street firing formation. Three ranks, the men in the first rank kneeling, the second stooping, the third aiming muskets at eye level. It's a strange move. I don't understand it. If Captain Laurie means to start a fight, his men are jammed into the small bridge area right out in the open, and the regulars are also outnumbered 3-1. Captain Laurie has ordered some regulars to rip up the planks of the bridge. He's going to try to stop the Minutemen from crossing. But there goes one plank and another.
Leave the plank! Leave the plank! This is our bridge!
That was Major Buttrick. He shouted angrily to the Redcoats to desist, to leave the planks. This is our bridge, Major Buttrick screamed. And the regulars have stopped. They've stopped tearing up the planks. The Minutemen are almost at the bridge now. The Redcoats are on the other side. Only about 75 feet or so of the Concord River separate the two groups. The Minutemen keep marching, and another minute or so... Three shots! The Redcoats fired three shots just now, but they splashed into the water. Another shot fired by a regular. Perhaps they're warnings. The Minutemen keep moving, though. Their band keeps playing. Oh, that's Captain Laurie. And the militia thundered back with all their muskets. They've ripped great holes in the scarlet line. Regulars have been hit. The ranks are broken. They're running for cover now. I've taken cover myself on this side of the bridge. The Minutemen are storming across the bridge, shooting after the Redcoats. It's a rout, a complete rout of the regulars. Several Minutemen have been hit. There aren't many, maybe six. The advance units of the Minutemen are across the bridge now. They've taken cover behind a stone wall, still firing at the regulars. Redcoats are stumbling over each other. No one is helping the wounded. Some of the men are crawling, limping. I've never seen regulars so demoralized, so confused. Major Buttrick's men aren't going on beyond the stone wall. The fire is letting up now. The men don't seem to be going into Concord. I'll try to get Major Buttrick and find out what he plans to do. Go ahead, Don Hollenbeck in New York.
Wow. This is actually quite a confusing part of the story here. I'm Ted O'Brien with Boston University's World of Ideas. You're listening to You Are There, and we're discussing it with historian Jill Lepore and broadcaster Bob Zelnick, both of whom are professors at Boston University. Who were the Redcoats at the North Bridge? Was this the same group that came up from Lexington or part of it that split off? Did some go into Concord and then some up to the bridge? What was going on here?
Here we're moving into territory where I cannot give you a definitive answer. I don't know. I'm not actually really up on the details of what happens exactly that day.
Okay, we do get a description of two groups clashing. And why? What's the wider context of this? This has been coming for what? Since the French and Indian War, and yet British regulars fought alongside the colonists in defeating the French and Indians.
And that was
only 14 years before.
Right. It was as a result of that war that the British Parliament decided to increase the revenue from the colonies because of the cost of defending them. And that's that was certainly one of the things that led to the series of acts that the colonists found so objectionable.
Yeah, there are three consequences from the French and Indian War that lead directly to the resistance movement. One is exactly that. The war was tremendously expensive. Great Britain believed that the colonists ought to pay for it. They believed that the war benefited the colonists and that they were the ones who ought to pay the bill, despite what the colonists had been promised during the war. So the colonists felt betrayed about that, and then all these new taxes are levied on them. Second of all, you're right, the colonists did fight alongside the British Army during the French and Indian War, and they came to hate them. One-third of all men in New England fought in the French and Indian War, and when they got into such close contact with British Army regulars, which is a professional army, a lot of these guys are not very well educated. They don't have families. They don't keep the Sabbath. They don't, they're not Christian in any active way. They're fairly coarse. There's a lot of prostitution, a lot of camp followers. And these New England men are really somewhat pious descendants of the Puritans who are greatly offended at what they see when they get up close with the British Army. And third of all, the French and Indian War has the consequence of greatly expanding the colonies. The territorial acquisitions of Britain in the New World mean that the American colonies are bigger now than Great Britain. So the Americans get grander visions.
Well, and you just gave us context. How much context do we get in a daily journalistic report?
Well, I think it depends on the story. If you're talking about the Middle East, I think you get a great deal of context because it's a problem that's been there for 50 years in its current incarnation, and it has been studied perhaps to excess, and I think you get all kinds of background in it. If you're talking about a movement in Afghanistan that seizes control, I think the background is kind of shabby because you haven't had the involvement. And I think, quite frankly, one of the issues in broadcast journalism today is how much of a foreign presence should we have? How much should reporters be around the world developing that context? So if something does happen, it's not like happening on the face of the moon.
It's been a great pulling back from that in my experience, just observing it.
You're absolutely right.
All right. Well, let's go to New York again, where, as we mentioned, the confusion in Concord, confusion is also quite evident.
We have more news here. Heavy reinforcements of His Majesty's regulars have left Boston for Concord. Almost 1,000 troops under Lord Percy are moving along the road to Lexington. It's believed the request for those additional troops came by courier from Colonel Smith and now Major Elliott.
1,000 fresh regulars on their way to Concord and the road swarming with newly arriving militia. These are fast-moving developments, and they are certainly ominous. Can Lord Percy get past Lexington without a clash? And what are his orders? Are they merely to help Colonel Smith accomplish his original objective? Or has General Gage suddenly decided on stern measures against the gathering colonists? The situation certainly is growing worse with every passing moment. It seems sure that neither Minuteman nor Regular wants war. And yet it seems that both are being forced into war by the dynamics of the struggle. Now, just a moment. Doug Edwards in Concord reports that Colonel Smith and his men have left Concord, heading back for Boston. Edwards is able to broadcast again, so come in, Doug Edwards.
The situation in Concord has been relieved for the moment at least, but no one is sure exactly what's happened. The last of His Majesty's regulars that occupied the town have left. Whether it's for good, we don't know, but they've left without any further bloodshed. So far, no arrests, no incidents after that one at North Bridge. All redcoat details are rejoining the main body of troops, and then they began their march back to Boston again by way of Lexington. Seems strange that Colonel Smith and Major Pitcairn attempted no retaliation for what happened at the North Bridge. The search for military stores proved fruitless, rather embarrassing for the redcoats. They seized a few barrels of flour, rolled them into the mill pond. They found some musket balls, threw them into the water too. Also, they spiked a few small cannon and burned their carriages. That was the smoke seen by Major Buttrick and his men.
The town folk here are milling about around the taverns, asking the big question, has Colonel Smith left for good, or does he intend to meet Lord Percy and return? The answer to that question is going to come soon enough, but even before Colonel Smith and Lord Percy meet, His Majesty's Redcoats, who have just left Concord, must pass through an area alive with angry, suspicious, nervous militiamen, their fingers itching on the triggers of their muskets. Can Colonel Smith run that gauntlet without trouble? We'll find that out in a matter of moments. John Daly, in a mobile unit, has now moved up from Lexington. He is now at an intersection on the road a mile from here called Merriam's Corner. The regulars are approaching, so over to John Daly.
Before we go over to John Daly, there are a couple of elements here that I want to talk about. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. This is Patriots Day, as CBS News saw it in 1948 and reported it, the events in Lexington, Concord, and now at Merriam's Corner. But before we get to that, Bob Zelnick, you were a reporter and a commentator and a writer for a goodly number of years before becoming the chairman of the Journalism Department at Boston University's College of Communication. We heard some commentary there. We heard the announcer say, neither side wants war, does this mean war, etc. We hear a lot of commentary nowadays. Does this have a long and rich tradition in journalism in America?
I think it goes back to the very origins of journalism in America. And in fact, some people who look back and see history through rose-colored glasses would be quite apologetic if they were aware of the caliber of journalism that was practiced in many quarters in the early days of our republic and even before that. I would interpret some of what we heard anyway as analysis, which I think is fair. I think a reporter on the scene can is probably qualified to make a judgment as to whether the parties want war or don't want war. He's probably had enough time to work the story a little bit, so I would give him the benefit of that doubt.
All right. Let's find out now what's going on at Merriam's Corner.
We pulled into a cluster of trees overlooking the road from Concord. This place is known as Merriam's Corner because a local farmer by that name has his house here. The thousands of Minutemen who were awakened by Paul Revere and William Dawes and all the other messengers who spread the alarm are strung out on both sides of the road all the way to Lexington and possibly beyond. They're unorganized, they have no officers, but they've got plenty of muskets and powder. They're all keeping out of sight, crouching behind barns and rocks, standing behind trees and stone walls, and now and then you can spot a head bobbing out, but wherever they are, every Minuteman is watching that great cloud of dust approaching Merriam's Corner from Concord, the dust thrown up by His Majesty's regulars. The advance units of the regulars are in sight. They seem to be tired. No fife and drum plays them on. There's no music. They're carrying their wounded in chaises along the center of the road. Some of the infantry walk up on a ridge which slopes down and joins the main road here at Merriam's Corner. The Redcoats are passing us now, moving into the ambush of Minutemen hidden on both sides of the road. The Redcoats must know that the Minutemen are here, watching them, for they seem to be uneasy, uncertain of themselves. This is a tense moment which will decide if there's going to be another tragic clash here at Merriam's Corner. Nothing has happened yet, however, and the regulars are deep in it. One of the Minutemen has fired at the Redcoats. The musket was fired from a rock or tree to my right. The Redcoats are firing back, and from behind trees and rocks, the militia have opened up. Flashes of musket fire, clouds of smoke up, popping all around me from both sides of the road. Every tree, every rock, every wall has suddenly come alive. The Redcoats are falling. His Majesty's Redcoats are falling, but they keep on marching because it's the only thing they can do. This can only mean war. There's no doubt about it. It's open rebellion. The colonial militia fired first here without provocation by the Redcoats, but the militiamen remember Lexington and North Bridge, and they've picked up the gauge of battle. The basketballs of the militiamen here at Merriman's Corner.
April 19th, 1775. The Minutemen fire first at Merriam's Corner, and open rebellion begins.
And there you have it. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests are Professor Jill Lepore and Professor Bob Zelnick of Boston University. Bob, Major Elliott said something quite significant at some point along the way. He made it appear that the situation could have been papered over as regrettable, something that happened at Lexington and at Concord. But it's clear that this, a running battle all the way back to Boston in which hundreds of British regulars were killed or wounded, is war.
It certainly is. I tell you, there are many different thoughts went through my mind as I was listening to this. And one is this was a recreation of a live report. You can see that it would be impossible today for a reporter to get permission from the troops. After all, he's sitting there saying, these guys are marching into an ambush, and this is so-and-so
right.
reporting live.
That's right.
And believe me, the other side's intelligence may not be great, but you don't want to broadcast on the radio or on television, which you can do instantly now, when your troops are laying an ambush for the enemy.
So a relief column of 1,000 men was sent out to assist them. The battles of Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill followed shortly thereafter. And what do we make of all this? Journalism, is it history without context, Bob? As you work with young people who are building their careers or hope to in that industry, are you throwing in a good deal of history and other?
Well, we're throwing in some. Yes, definitely. I teach a course, for example, in foreign reporting, and I talk about the former Soviet Union. I talk about Israel, where I work. Those were two posts that I enjoyed when I was with ABC. We talk about Cuba. We talk about many places. And there's a tremendous amount of context that you build in, because I don't see how a reporter can be effective unless he or she does provide that kind of context.
Well, and I want to thank you for your participation, and you, Professor Lepore. I'm Ted O'Brien. You've been listening to A Different Take on April 18th, 1775, with the help of CBS, which gave us permission to replay excerpts from that program, and with Professor Robert Zelnick of the College of Communication and Professor Jill Lepore of Boston University's History Department. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild with help from Mike Toda and Tina Toby. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.